Definitely.
Got it. Okay.
Okay, great. And should I call you Bill or Dr. McDonough or what?
Oh, please, Bill.
Bill. Okay, I'm Guy. I'm no
Hi,
PhD.
guy.
We have some NCA swag, carrying bag, t-shirt, hat, and stuff like that. And I'll send you a file which has the choices, and you then email me back with what choice. There's a bunch of colors and sizes and stuff, and we will send that to you. So are you living in Japan, or are you normally living in Maryland or near here?
Up until last December, I was doing both. I was a half-time tenured faculty member, not too many of them. In 2017, I began this cycle of being a since 2000, I've been a professor at UMass Maryland Geology. In 2017, I took a professorship at the Tohoku University
Oh,
in the
wow.
Research Center for Neutrino Science and in earth sciences. So I began teaching for half a year in Japan and half a year in America. And I've been doing that since 17. And I decided that this year when I turn 70, I'm retiring because got plenty of money and I just want to do pure research. And so in fact, in June, July, I will retire at the academic fiscal year.
All right.
But
Well,
I'll keep
great.
coming back to Maryland because I still have three active grants.
Wow. How's your Japanese?
Please, please, please.
Is it
They,
Arigato?
it's very, it's a work in progress, and I need an infinite amount of time.
And that you don't have.
Right. But my job is here to actually teach my graduate course in English so that they get better at English, which is bad because that means I don't learn Japanese.
Right. I'm always amazed at the number of Americans who live abroad and work abroad and don't hardly learn a word of the language. It's kind of amazing.
Well, I did work at a Max Planck Institute in Germany back in the 80s, and I actually gave lecture to them in German. But people would often say, please, off English.
Well, welcome everybody. It's now 7:30 by my clock, and this is the March monthly meeting for National Capital Astronomers. And you can see the website capitalastronomers.org. And we're going to have a lecture by William McDonough, who's on the screen here, who's speaking to us from Japan on neutrino geoscience, which is something I don't know very much about at all. So I hope you can all see this screen here that I'm my waving my mouse on. You can all say,
Yes.
yeah.
Yes, I see it.
Great. Okay, now I want to go to the next slide and nothing's happening. What am I, why is that not happening? Oh, now, okay.
It
So
did.
agenda, we got announcements. Does anybody have any announcements right now that they would like to make to everybody? Anybody out there? Okay. Well, one thing is coming up actually tomorrow. I'm supposed to clear up tomorrow. And at Lake Artemisia, which is not too far from here, as a matter of fact, they've asked for some telescopes. That's the Maryland National Capital Park and Planning Commission. And I'd like to get some people there. The Exploring the Sky is going to start in April, and it's going to actually happen 2 days before the eclipse. So I'm not going to be around. I'm going to be in Texas. And for the eclipse itself, we have here a bunch of glasses that we had printed up. We've given that away, several hundred already. and I wanted to give a demo of a safe solar viewer and talk about some local distant viewing events before and after, and also about the science fairs. So first of all, Lake Artemisia, that's this thing. Oopsie. Go back. Okay, so here we are at the University of Maryland Observatory on Metzrot Road. So if you take Metzrot, it eventually joins up with Greenbelt Road. And then you have to do this really complicated thing here, and you get down here to Lake Artemisia, which is really a surprisingly nice little thing. It's actually right next to Greenbelt Park, which is right over there. And this was Lakeland, which was used to be a residential, but torn down. So we could use some people with telescopes starting at 6:30 p.m. And this is the Exploring Sky schedule. I hope this is the right one. I'm not sure I got the most updated one, but the next event will be on April 6th at 8 p.m. And we could definitely use people for that. I wanted to talk also about a safe solar viewer. I wanted to bring my own, but I put it someplace safe down in the basement, and I couldn't find it. But basically, you have two lenses. This one is a convex one, pretty long focal length, and this one is a negative one, or concave one, or also known as a Barlow. And I did remember to bring the
necessary
this thing, cinder block, because it turns out to be very, very helpful. And it's surprising what a good image you can get. The lenses from Surplus Shed cost about 10 or 11 bucks. So that's his latest version. He doesn't use wood anymore. He uses a long box from, I think, I don't know, one of those packing companies. And in the back, there are images of the sun. And if there are any sunspots, they're quite visible. And the aluminum foil here is so that when you have this lens here, which is basically held in like tape and cardboard, and if it gets a little bit off center, it's okay because it reflects back. And here's my latest version. And it's some flooring I happen to have around. Okay, so that's, let's see. Let me go back a sec. There was a couple something I want to put. Yeah, so Elizabeth, what can you tell us about events here at campus on the day of the eclipse, April 8th?
We're going to have an eclipse viewing event on campus. We are still trying to nail down the exact location. It will probably be, we were looking at the engineering fields, but now I am actually considering the place where we set up for Maryland Day, where we usually put the big tent for Maryland Day, which is in front of like the math and physics, math, engineering, old engineering buildings, sort of in the grassy area there. But okay, That's all along campus drive when you kind of come on. So we're kind of finalizing. There's probably going to be some other activities. There's a light sound activity. They also have the animal noise thing that they're going to set up to see how much it changes.
Oh.
Grad students have a couple of different little things that they're coordinating. And then they're going to dump it into my lap because they're going to go see the eclipse. So right now, I mean, we are holding an event. Our rain location is going to be in the physical sciences building down in the ground lobby, the main lobby of PSC. So we've got our rain location set. And if we do end up going there, we'll be have a computer hooked up and showing some streams from the eclipse from somewhere. We'll get the activity set up down there. So probably still have the telescopes kind of set up inside just to show people the equipment. So we've got the rain location set. We're just trying to nail down the actual observing location. We've got all the construction on campus because of the purple line.
Oh.
And that's kind of messing up some of our preferred spots. And so we're having, I'm trying, I'm re we're reconsidering based on that construction.
Okay. And I think there's also going to be stuff down on the National Mall near the Air and Space, but I don't think I've heard any details about
I
that.
have not gotten any details
Yeah.
yet.
And there's some other events. They want speakers, and I've committed to doing a couple of things at local schools. Anybody else have any announcements along that line? Okay. So with the science fairs, John Hutzel went to see a pretty amazing science fair that was put on by students in DC from public, private, charter, parochial, you name it, who had been working with people in the Department of Defense. He was absolutely blown away by the quality, incredibly high quality of the exhibits. There weren't a whole lot that really had much to do with astronomy, but we may or may not re recognize them. I started looking at the ones for that the Office of the State Superintendent of Education, or OSSE, has put together, and unfortunately, they don't seem to have their act together. They've only got this year a grand total of 50 entries, and it's not even a really a STEM or science thing. It's STEAM, and the A stands for arts. So some of the exhibits are actually just paintings or poems that have nothing to do whatsoever with science. So I think it's that the people organizing that thing are don't have connections with the schools, because I called around to some of the schools and said, oh yeah, we had a science fair, but they didn't know anything about this, and the gal in charge of DC for STEM didn't know about them. So hopefully that will, can be fixed. Used to be the Carnegie Institution's Academy for Science Education took a great big part in that, and OSSE parted ways for with them back in 2018. Now, not everybody does science fair projects. I didn't. I did other experiments. How many people here actually did science fair things when you were little? Okay. All right. How many went to them? And looked at this. I certainly went to them. I was impressed. I'm a little scared. I'll be quite honest. I'll be cool. Okay, so that's all I have. And so I'm going to turn this over to John Hornstein, our vice president, who needs to be replaced next year. Don't forget, all we want people to sign up for his position.
Have the not the officers, but the other board member dudes, the four other ones.
Trustees?
Trustees, have they called around asking members if they'd be able to help out?
Have you?
Trustees?
Have you? Okay, please do so.
Well,
Okay.
I think you have to assign them to
Okay.
y'all need, hey, trustees, this is how y'all can help out.
All right.
And call around and drum up some
Right, I
candidates.
can very easily just take our membership and say, okay,
Yeah.
you got these, you got these, you got these. I'll take those.
Yeah.
Let's see what happens. Okay. Thank you for the suggestion. Okay, John.
Guy, hey Guy,
Yes.
before we go on to the speaker, one comment about Lake Artemisia. I stopped by there a couple times while I was working in Greenbelt. Now, just be aware that there are, or at least there were then, lots and lots of Canada geese.
Did they want to look through the telescope?
No, but be very careful where you step and where you put
And
things
wear
down
a
on the
hat.
ground.
Let me stop sharing. I'm going to try to also get some speakers running here so that people can hear. Right. Let's see. Lost my view. All right, you should be able to share, Bill, if you want to start sharing.
Okay, let's see. Oh, I'm doing the wrong thing already. Look at that, I'm nervous. Let's see.
I'm working on it.
I should be
There
able
it is.
to. Right now, slideshow. That's not what I want, is it? No. I know how to do this. F5. Yeah, that's what I want. No.
Okay, I will introduce you. It is a great pleasure to introduce Bill McDonough, a speaker this evening. Each second, about 65 billion neutrinos pass through each of your fingernails or any other surface having the same small area. A larger number passes through your entire body. Most of those neutrinos come from the sun. Here is a quote from Frank Close's excellent book on neutrinos. The quote is from the Nobel Prize ceremony in 2002. With X-rays, which penetrate much more than ordinary light, you can see inside your hand. With neutrinos, you can look inside the sun. As we will hear this evening, with neutrinos, you can also look deep inside the Earth. Neutrinos interact so weakly with matter and with electromagnetic radiation that the large flux of solar neutrinos through you rarely causes any damage and is not felt or seen by you. By the way, here and in many other non-technical discussions, neutrinos, the word neutrinos is used as an umbrella term for neutrinos and/or antineutrinos, antineutrinos being the antiparticles of neutrinos. Where do all those neutrinos come from? They come from the radioactive decay of uranium, thorium, potassium, and the radioactive isotope cesium-137 in the Earth, and many neutrinos come from the sun and presumably from the moon and from other bodies. In fact, trace amounts of radioactive calcium and potassium in our teeth and bones produce neutrinos. About the neutrinos from the sun, that neutrinos interact extremely weakly is actually very important to us. The sun is supported against gravitational collapse by the reactions that produce the neutrinos from the sun. The extreme weakness of interactions by neutrinos means that those reactions are slow, which means that the sun loses its energy slowly, which is why it has remained a star instead of having already become a white dwarf long enough for the Earth to host the development and evolution of living creatures. Bill McDonough, a speaker this evening, is in the Geology Department of the University of Maryland. He's an expert in developing and using mass spectrometers, which measure the amount of isotopes of various masses in the biological and geological samples. In particular, he is an expert in measuring the flux of electron-type antineutrinos from the Earth, and in using those measurements to pin down the multi-layered internal structure of the Earth. Bill?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much for the introduction. I send greetings from Japan and how it feels like after the sa daylight savings time has changed. Thank you for that introduction. It gives us a sort of a starting point to think about neutrinos. In 1984, there was a nice paper in Nature that talked about neutrino astronomy and neutrino geophysics. And from that point onwards, many of us have sort of begun to work in a field that didn't exist prior to that. And it's really to harness the strengths of what we get from neutrinos to understand aspects of the cosmos and aspects of the Earth. And in fact, I'd say that I just came from a conference in Hong Kong 2.5 weeks ago. And there was a lot talked about in terms of particle astrophysics, And we're just now beginning to have results from particle geophysics. And I should get rid of this. How do I get rid of that? Hide video panel, I think. Nope. All right, I can't see. Let's see. Hide something else. Hide floating meeting controls. There. Good. Here is just a highlight of Pingu. On the right side, these three detectors here are the three detectors that have or are counting electron antineutrinos from the Earth, which for the most part include geoneutrinos, but are also produced during nuclear reactions in nuclear reactors around the world for power. This is the Borexino detector. There's a pair of legs at the top of that for scale. This is the Japanese Camlan detector, and you can see two people for scale here. And the Camlan detector is essentially the same size as the schematic diagram for the snow detector in Canada. This was the first detector. The Japanese detector began detecting electron antineutrinos in 2002. It continues to detect them today. The Borexino detector in Italy began a few years later, detected for about 15 years, and has been shut down now. The snow detector began counting 2 years ago, 2+ years ago. And I'm pretty excited. It will actually give us some neutrino results later this year. Over here, we see images of the detector called IceCube, which is at the South Pole. With the prospects in the future of having Pingu was not funded, but Pingu is an example of an interior addition to IceCube that would help in the field called neutrino oscillation, Hyper-K likewise, and also KM3-NET, a detector field in the Mediterranean, are the types of detectors that the future will hold for neutrino oscillation studies. And I'll get into these two different types of studies that will tell us aspects of the Earth. Down here in the lower right, something called a mobile ocean-going detector, and I will mention that towards the end. A little bit was talked about in terms of neutrino sources and fluxes. And we start out here at the bottom in terms of natural radioactivity inside the Earth. One way to think about this is the beta decay scheme as two branches. Beta plus and beta minus. In the beta minus decay scheme, you're essentially going from a lower proton number to a higher proton number by the neutron changing to a proton. In the beta plus, so you're going the opposite way from a higher proton number now to a lower proton number. Both of those radioactive branches have and do exist in the Earth, and they give a flux of geoneutrinos. Additionally, we know that reactors also produce a flux of antineutrinos. And several years ago in 2016, I and some other of my colleagues produced a map of the world. And this is a map of the nuclear reactor flux on a global scale. This would be the reactors in Northern Hemisphere. You can perhaps see this is over in Japan, Europe, and North America. And this is down in South America, and this would be the African, southernmost African nuclear reactors. So we know of the reactors and the neutrino fluxes from them. Additionally, we can get it from particle accelerators, cosmic rays, stars, supernova, black hole, and of course, the Big Bang produced a vast number of neutrinos, of which there are still existing in the universe, but these would be very, very weak. One perspective is that the Earth is an antineutrino star. It has been referred to that in the past. It shines with about 10 to the 25 geoneutrinos per second. And all simply due to beta minus radioactive decay ongoing inside the Earth. Yes, indeed, it has been several Nobel Prizes have been given in neutrino science. I would highlight that in 2015, I was actually told at the moment of the announcement, and so I, with others, clicked onto the Nobel Prize website, was able to watch the announcement, and I was pleased when I saw that this slide, about the third or fourth slide, showed that the geoneutrinos were being talked about at the Nobel announcement lecture, when Art McDonald and Kajita-san both received the Nobel Prize for their discovery. Also highlighted, what are geoneutrinos? They are very specifically electron antineutrinos from the Earth, the products of natural radioactivity. The other type of electron antineutrinos are those from the reactor. The typical flux on in the continental region is around 6 million per centimeter squared per second. That would be a flux of, take a sort of a standard size fingernail, and that flux of neutrinos coming per second is distributed everywhere on the surface, if you will. In this fermion diagram, we basically have quarks and leptons. Amongst the leptons, we all tend to be familiar with the electrons, the muons, and the taus. Likewise, we would have electron neutrino, muon neutrino, and tau neutrino. Additionally, we'd have their antimatter components behind them. And so this is the fundamental particle that we are talking about. Oh, the decay process, beta minus decay processes, can be found in a variety of decay chains, including the thorium and uranium decay chain, which is dominated by alpha particles, but there are beta particle decay steps. When a neutron is decaying to a proton, you end up having a down quark going to an up quark with the production of the electron antineutrino occurring at that same time. The first detection, well, the idea of a neutrino was proposed in the 1930s, but the first detection of the electron antineutrino was by Rhinus and Cohen. Rhinus got the Nobel Prize. By that time, Cohen had passed away. But this is an image of their experiment down at the Savannah River Laboratories. This is their detector about 10 meters away from a nuclear reactor, where they were able to actually observe the electron antineutrinos occurring from the nuclear decay process. The way these are being detected, because it was highlighted that these are chargeless and near massless particles, was that an electron antineutrino entering into the scintillation oil would essentially interact with a free proton. It would break that free proton into a positron. The positron would be carrying the energy of the electron antineutrino. That energy tag would essentially identify what was the source of this electron antineutrino. It would, within less than a picosecond, annihilate due to the interaction of electron positron exchange. You would get a series of gamma events that would give you the prompt energy associated with the electron antineutrino. At that same time, you'd be producing a neutron that would go through a random thermalizing walk, if you will, in the scintillation oil. It would combine with another free proton. The neutron plus the proton would end up making deuterium, which would result in a energy release of 2.2 MeV. In the result of this, what's called inverse beta decay coincidence or measurement, you have two flashes of light separated by 200 microseconds, with the second flash of light being 2.2 MeV, and therefore you have an elimination of background because of these two flashes of light with the second known energy. However, this electron antineutrino must carry with it 1.8 MeV of light in order to have this reaction occur whatsoever. This is what we are using today to actually detect thorium and uranium derived electron antineutrinos occurring in the Earth. Here again is the highlighting of that process. Electron antineutrinos interacts with a proton, produces a neutron plus a positron. This would be the detection rate measured on the y-axis and the neutrino energy on the x-axis. And you would end up with a spectrum from uranium, where you'd have two peaks of discrete energy. Likewise, in 232 thorium, you'd also have two peaks, but they are overlapping considerably. And thus, this would be the idealized spectrum for the uranium and thorium coming from the Earth. In this case, I've also idealized the commercial reactor spectrum, and I've developed this synthetic spectrum to essentially idealize it for the Earth, because I'd put the closest reactor on the order of 1,000 kilometers away. A little bit later, I will show you the actual comparison with the Japanese spectrum, which doesn't look as pretty as this. Oh, I'm sorry, it's the next one. So here you can see the geoneutrinos in red and the reactor background in mustard color. What you can see was the Camlin, the Japanese detector, which is right here. It was designed to measure reactor antineutrinos. On the island of Japan, you have, at the time, 52 nuclear power reactors, and therefore it was a fantastic place to be able to measure the spectrum of antineutrinos, particularly from nuclear reactors. However, in this case, in our perspective, the nuclear reactor antineutrino spectrum was the most significant contributor to the total signal. This had to be subtracted in order to get this signal in red. With the great 2011 Tohoku earthquake, or the very large earthquake that happened in 2011 causing a tsunami in Japan, all Japanese nuclear reactors were shut down. Consequently, the Camlin experiment, which continued, ended up being a spectacular success for geoneutrinos, because as a consequence, this reactor background virtually went away. Additionally, the Japanese were able to also detect nuclear reactors in South Korea, which were still continuing to operate and were bright enough for us to see that far away. This was also, this spectrum was also reported on in Nature in 2005. The 2005 Nature article ended up being the discovery article for geoneutrinos. It was the first time we were able to measure and report on the Earth's geoneutrino flux. What are we using the geoneutrino flux to tell us about? In large part, it is actually helping the geoscience community significantly. It's telling us how much fuel is left to drive the dynamics inside the Earth, in particular, plate tectonics. We know the Earth emits around 46 terawatts of energy. This has actually been a number that's been established for more than 70 years. The number has been varying by a little low, 10 to 15%. The uncertainties current day is down around 6% on this number. where the energy for this internal earth comes from. It's generally partitioned into two components, the primordial energy and the radiogenic energy. The radiogenic energy comes from radioactive decay. The primordial energy can be thought of as coming from a couple of different sources. Primarily, the mass of the planet is 6 times 10 to the 24 kilograms. The incoming particle, such as asteroids, are usually current day, as well as in the past, coming in at 10 to 20 kilometers per second. If you just take that as kinetic energy starting number, you end up with around 10 to the 32 joules. And that number of 10 to the 32 joules is consistent with what we would estimate for what is the energy associated with building of the Earth. The gravitational energy of separating out a metallic core would give you something like 10 to the 28 to 10 to the 30 joules of energy. And then additionally, in the Earth, it started out with a significant budget of short-lived isotopes. Their decay happened long ago. The dissipation of that energy from the interior is still ongoing. This would make up the primordial, whereas the radiogenic is the instantaneous release from the Earth. The problem that we have with trying to understand the significant amount of these two sources is really to try to understand how fast the Earth cools down. This diagram on the right, I'll get to at the very end, but it's talking about internal structures of the Earth and how we may image them inside the Earth. So geoneutrino detection is really going to help us to sort out what is the proportion of primordial to radiogenic energy inside the Earth. This simple pie diagram, which actually looks at the surface heat flow and tries to divide its components, has essentially four major components: the radiogenic energy that's in the continental crust, the radiogenic energy that's in the mantle, and the secular cooling that we associated with the mantle and the core. There is a small contribution of energy that would come from tidal dissipation, as well as what's called chemical differentiation. One idea of chemical differentiation would be the crystallization of the inner core, which likely started over the last billion years. And currently, we have an inner core that's about 70% the size of the moon. But the estimates for the growth in energy from that exothermic reaction is still very small, essentially about 1% of the energy of the system. This crust and mantle contribution is assuming a model, one that I have put forth. And together, it suggests that the amount of radiogenic energy in the Earth is about 40% of the total, or 20 plus or minus 4. The number we know well of 7 terawatts of power is for the continental crust. And the continental crust, we know its composition reasonably well. There's some debate about this and that model, but the debate on the composition of continental crust is within 25% or so. The composition of the mantle, there is really a factor of three debate about that, and this remains a very large unknown, and I can highlight that. But essentially, the total radiogenic power of the Earth is best estimated as 20 plus or minus 10. The value of 20 plus or minus 4 is the model that I estimated in 1995. The value 20 plus or minus 10 would represent the three dominant models that have predicted how much power is in the Earth. Some scientists have suggested that there's only around 10 terawatts of power of radiogenic energy in the Earth, whereas others have just suggested as much as 30 terawatts of power in the Earth. These different models of the Earth have been essentially put forth and represent an unknown that can be tested from the geoneutrino flux model methods. The cooling numbers, again, are quite uncertain. This is 18 terawatts, this is 9 terawatts. This 9 terawatts varies from 4 to 15. These are big unknowns. And the problem with these unknowns is we do not actually have a very good model for how fast the Earth cools. In simple terms, you can think of the Earth's mantle as really a ceramic insulator, and you can think of the metallic core as a conductor of heat, right? So the heat of the interior is being released as fast as it can from the core, but it's really being modulated by the speed at which the thermal insulator, the silicate earth, wants to release the earth's internal heat. As I said, the bulk silicate earth compositional models that have been proposed have talked about a 10 terawatt earth, a 20 terawatt earth, a 30 terawatt earth. If we then divide those into the different proportions, as I've highlighted, the continental crust is so well known that really what we're talking about in terms of the system is a constant 6.8 terawatts for the continental crust, but proportionally higher amounts for the mantle. And you can see that it would vary from 3 to 23 terawatts of power in the Earth's mantle. And therefore, the silicate models vary by a factor of 3, whereas the mantle models vary by a factor of 20. And this is where geoneutrinos can directly define the power to drive the Earth's engine. That is placing your perspective on why geoscience values the insights that come from geoneutrinos. How do we actually turn a flux of geoneutrinos measured by experimental methods from the particle physics community into geological information? The geological community are constructing 3D reference models for the Earth. So, if in the case of actually this green square, if on top of this green square we have a geoneutrino detector, we really are trying to voxelate the Earth, which are voxels are like pixels, except that a voxel is a volume element. We end up assigning chemical and physical states to Earth voxels. So every 1 degree by 1 degree by so many kilometers deep, we assign a chemical state, which is, in essence would be the concentration of uranium and thorium, and a physical state, which would be the density in each one of these voxels. And we would do that for everywhere, every voxel in the Earth that we've defined. This will be the only equation I will use, and I will actually show you that it's relatively simple in some terms. This is really trying to measure the flux of electron antineutrinos at a particular point from a distance of from the detector. Here we're looking at the activity and number of geoneutrinos that get produced as a result of simple decay processes, the volume of the source unit, and that's really talking about the volume of the Earth, the abundance and density of the source unit. So this is the abundance of uranium, the abundance of thorium. This is the density of the rock at that point. So R prime would represent the source position, and R here would represent the detector position. So here we're talking about the distance between the source unit and the detector. And so what you can see, particularly because this is raised to the power 2, it is really telling you that the sensitivity of a detector drops off with the square of the distance away. Finally, we have this thing called a survival probability, and we'll actually look at that a little bit later. But there is a unique aspect of neutrinos, which says that a neutrino, as it travels through space, oscillates between three different eigenmass states, or flavor states, if you will. A neutrino will be produced at a point X as it moves through the universe. It will change from electron state to a muon state to a tau state to an electron state. Currently, we do not know which state, well, we do know that they're produced in the electron neutrino state, but we do not know really certain identities of that state. And in particular, when we're measuring it, we're not aware of which one's the heavy to light mass and other attributes of it. So these are being studied by the particle physics community to understand their fundamental properties, and being studied by the geological community to understand the radioactive flux in the Earth. So the contributions that the geoscientists really offer to this is really looking at the density and L, the density structure of the Earth. L would be the distribution, or how far away the signal is, and the A would be the abundance of that particular element at some distance. To give you a perspective, in the entire Earth, this is just one model. We would end up having approximately 13 nanograms per gram uranium in the entire Earth. In the metallic sphere, or the core, there'd be much less than 1 nanogram per gram uranium. This is established with the idea that if you were to have a molten silicate material and a molten metallic material, the uranium would partition into the molten silicate material. Although it's frequently thought of that uranium, being the heaviest element, should be in the core, this is really driven by electromagnetic bonding reactions, not by gravitational or Newtonian forces. So the core ends up being depleted in uranium, and the silicate sphere, both the crust and the mantle, ends up being the reservoir for uranium. And I highlight here that there's 20 nanograms per gram estimated uranium, but the asterisk refers to, here are two models. O'Neill and Palmy in 2008 suggested only 10 nanograms per gram. Turcotte and Schubert in 2002 suggested 31 nanograms per gram. So 20, 10, and 30 essentially represent the three different, let's say, competing models for the composition of the Earth. Today, as a result of what I would call chromatographic separation, mantle melting, and crust formation, you end up with essentially a factor of 100 difference between the concentration of uranium in the continental crust and the concentration of uranium in the mantle. Essentially 1300 nanograms and 12 nanograms in on average in these two different bodies. Here exist the neutrino telescopes that are actually working to understand the Earth's concentration. This would be the first detector, the one in Japan that began, called the CAMLAN detector. The LAND stands for Liquid Antineutrino Detector. The Borexino detector began shortly after that one. It's in central Italy. It counted for about 12 years, if I remember right, and has been shut down, disassembled, and redeployed into other components. The Canadian Snow Plus detector and an active nickel mine has been counting for the last 2+ years, and we expect it to essentially be reported on in 2024. I was talking to the principal investigator on the Snow Plus experiment just 2 weeks ago in Hong Kong, and he has promised that they're reporting later this year. Two more detectors, Juno and the Chinese Jinping Laboratory, are this one is under construction current day. This one's under development. This one here under construction, part of the reason I was in Hong Kong and southern China was because I was at this detector as a collaborator, and we had a collaboration meeting just essentially about 12 days ago. The collaboration represents around 700 scientists, 20 different institutions around the world. This experiment is about a half a billion dollars worth of equipment. And it's a major advance in this field, given that this is a 1 kiloton detector, 1 kiloton detector, 0.3 kiloton detector, whereas the Chinese Juno detector is a 20 kiloton detector, 20 times the size of the other types of detectors. So in fact, this Juno detector is expected to come online in 2026, and 1 year of Juno data will give us more signal than all three of these other detectors collectively over the decades have been able to give us. So this will be a major advance in our abilities and understanding. This would represent the current measurements that we've been seeing over the period of time. The y-axis here, there is no x-axis. The y-axis here is in TNU, which is terrestrial neutrino units. It is the way to normalize between different detectors around the world. It represents one event over a year-long exposure of 10 to the 32 protons. 10 to the 32 protons would represent the number of protons that would be expected in a kiloton detector. And what we're seeing imaged in this figure is the Japanese and the Italian experiments with different thicknesses for the signal from the mantle, signal from the crust from very far away, and signal from the crust that's very close. And these are the kinds of this would represent the models from the geologist to explain the signal seen at each of these detectors. Here we have an image of the Earth and its predicted global geoneutrino flux. And what you can see in this image is that the mantle beneath the oceans essentially has a very dim or not very bright geoneutrino signal, but from the continents you get a bright signal, and in particular where such as here you're seeing that the Himalayas, very thick continental crust, gives us some of the brightest geoneutrino signals we have. So roughly speaking, the luminous crust reflects also a thick continental crust in the sea. When talking about the signal in the mantle, we're very much muted compared to the continental crust. However, seismologists have been able to identify what we would call seismically slow or red regions deep inside the mantle. This is a 3D image of the Earth's interior. The blue would represent the surface of the core. So the CMB for us is not the cosmic microwave background, but the core mantle boundary. This would represent the surface of the Earth. In two regions, what we would call the degree two structure of the Earth, we see in the South Atlantic region a very large seismically slow region. In the South Pacific, another seismically slow region. And these are very well seismically imaged, and so we ask what is potentially hidden deep in the mantle. The next question we ask is, can we image such structures with geoneutrinos? In 2013, my former postdoc Andrei Shoramik and I and others together constructed a model using the previous seismic image to have a different aspect or a different characteristic uranium and thorium content than the rest of the mantle. And from that, we were able to show that the Atlantic model and the Pacific model of those two structures would have a slightly brighter geoneutrino signal than the ambient mantle surrounding it. What you can see in terms of the total flux or luminosity of that region is really about a 20% variation in that system. And from that, we're actually talking about testing the Earth's geoneutrino internal flux with a detector such as the one we're talking about here. This would be a mobile neutrino telescope, an experiment with joint interest in physics and geology, as well as security. And when I say in physics, it really would be equally valuable for looking at studying the fundamental particle, as well as looking at neutrino sources from the cosmos, as in the astral particle physics experiments that are ongoing in IceCube and elsewhere. So for a little bit more than 2 decades, we've been looking at this type of experiment, a deep ocean antineutrino observatory, in which this volume here of the observatory is essentially scalable from 1 to 50 kilotons, with a 10-year cost around $250 million for a 10 kiloton neutrino telescope. We would take such a neutrino telescope, tow it into the open ocean, and essentially deploy it on the bottom of the open ocean for a period of time, say 1 or 2 years. Use the deep water as a cosmic shield. Look at it in an L over E sense, where L is distance and E is the energy of the neutrinos. The way to look at this or think about this is you could put it in the southern Pacific Ocean, where it would be 3,000 kilometers away from South America, 3,000 kilometers away from Australia, and 3,000 kilometers away from the core mantle boundary. And we'd be able to see an exclusive mantle signature and potentially image the very well-defined seismic structures and begin to ask, are these distinctive in terms of the concentrations of thorium and uranium in the Earth? And would that tell us about their origins? In this new ocean-based experiment, we could go from the, let's say, the far northern portions of the Pacific Ocean to the far southern portions of the Pacific Ocean and map out what would be the flux variation seen in that area. So we could do neutrino tomography of the Earth's interior. We would avoid continents. We would deploy at 4 kilometers depth, leaving at each location for 1 year and being able to map out the Earth's interior in this manner. Like I said, in the past, we've actually produced a map of the Earth's neutrino structure. Here you can see the image of the Himalayas. We actually looked at the individual contributions down here. This is a map of just the potassium geoneutrino flux. And here is a map of just the reactor flux. Finally, I'd like to just highlight an aspect of where this field is going. A simple Venn diagram I put together, this would represent the particle and nuclear physics community. This would represent the geology community. And in terms of neutrinos, we have studies of geoneutrinos, oscillation neutrinos, and absorption neutrinos. In terms of flux, coming from the universe. The geoneutrinos represents a very small portion of the energy scale, and neutrino oscillations again essentially represents neutrinos that are coming to the Earth in the GeV scale. Or let's just say, I should say, particles coming to the Earth in the GeV scale that are essentially colliding with the atmosphere and producing neutrinos in the atmosphere that will penetrate to the Earth. The neutrino oscillations, so I've covered the geoneutrinos because they're really looking at the radioactive power in the mantle and core and giving us these kinds of estimates. The neutrino oscillations are just coming into now into vi view for because we can be able to look at questions such as how much water is there in the mantle, or how much hydrogen is in the core. So these two types of questions are really being asked by this kind of experiment, electron density testing in terms of the Earth. In that sense, we are using this quality factor called Z over A, which is the proton number of the atomic mass. We can estimate that for the Earth's silicate shell, and we can estimate that for the Earth's metallic shell. Yes. Yes. I only had two slides left. Apparently, we're having technical problems. Hello?
We can still hear and see you. You're fine from our end. I think you just heard someone coughing, but you're good.
Okay. Didn't mean to go so long. Sorry, I was just.
No, you're fine. You're all good.
All right, I have to figure out what I was doing. Let's see. Doom, doom. All right. The final thought is really associated with testing the hydrogen content of the Earth. And the reason is because the oscillation state of a neutrino that I had mentioned earlier is oscillating between the electron, the muon, and the tau component. As a neutrino of a certain energy passes through the Earth, its oscillation state can be measured and as well predicted. So as a neutrino coming in from the North Pole, passing through the center of the Earth and being detected at the South Pole ice cube experiment, would have a different oscillation period in this sense than one traveling through, say, a latitude such as Washington, D.C., coming through perhaps, oh, I should. Should have used my pointer. There, from the North Pole to the ice cube detector in the South Pole, or from a latitude, say Washington, D.C., traveling towards the ice cube detector in the South Pole. One sees the Earth's core, the other one sees only perhaps the core mantle boundary. If we then think about the system having multiple detectors, say this is the ice cube detector in the South Pole. This is the KM3 net that is now being built in the Mediterranean. We're looking at neutrinos generated in the upper atmosphere in different locations and passing through the Earth. By looking at a family of neutrinos created in the 2 to 8 GeV portion of the spectrum, we can look at their oscillograms or their passage through the Earth in the muon state, and we can do it either in the neutrino or the antineutrino, and we could see whether or not we have models that essentially are consistent with or not consistent with having significant masses of hydrogen in the Earth's interior. These experiments are only theoretically being evaluated today. And we believe that within the next 50 years, we will be able to put constraints on the amount of hydrogen in the interior of the Earth. To put the present speculations into perspective, Earth scientists believe that we may have as little as one ocean mass of water in the Earth's interior, or as much as 10 ocean masses of water in the Earth's interior. That is a very large difference, and we have been debating that question, as well as the question of when it was delivered and how it was delivered. And thus, in I would estimate in less than 50 years, with the ever-building ice cube detector in the South Pole, the KMT, the KM3 net in the Mediterranean, something like the Hanno-Hanno experiment that might go on, etc., we should be able to evaluate the question of the amount of hydrogen in the Earth's interior and essentially be able to pin down that question for Earth scientists. The conclusion is really focused right now on the geoneutrino flux model because that's where we have numbers. The neutrino oscillation studies is where we're looking to get numbers, but that is still a 50-year horizon question. The current state includes the Japanese and the Italian experiments have reached about their total possible limit on uncertainties of their signals. They're asymptotic right now, around 15 to 20% on their uncertainties. This diagram is essentially made up of two components. The total signal measured by the physicist. Here I highlighted this is the measured signal. The lithospheric signal, which represents the crust and the adjacent coupled mantle right beneath it. This is the predicted signal by geologists. The intercept represents the mantle signal. So this is a three-component diagram, and this means the slope of this line must equal one. So in this case, you have the fit for the Camlin and the Borexino because that's the data that's published. This year, we hope to have the signal from SNOW+. The geologists have already predicted the x-axis, and we're going to see if the y-axis is essentially 42 TNU. In around 2026, the Chinese Juno experiment, we have the x-axis here predicted to be about 40. And we're seeing if the y-axis will come out around 52 or thereabouts. Currently, based upon these two numbers here, we have an estimate for the TNU from the mantle, about 9. And that gives us around 20 plus or minus, essentially a little bit less than 10. So, in the last 20 years of analysis by the particle physics, we have gotten to the point where we can actually put quantitative numbers on the Earth's geoneutrino flux, the Earth's power, and we essentially now are at the point where we're measuring the exact same numbers that the Earth scientists have been predicting for a half a century. But I can tell you that in the next 5 years, we're going to be moving this uncertainty to about half or even less than half of that. And therefore, it will be pretty exciting times because we will be able to actually tell the Earth science community what is the power inside the Earth. Thank you.
We have some questions. Okay, Jeffrey, looks like you have your hand up.
Well, that was actually the clapping thing emoji, but I do have a question. And these are all scintillation detectors.
Well, for electron antineutrinos, yes, indeed, these are scintillation detectors. Let me just You're right there. So these three here, as well as the proposed ocean-going detectors, are all scintillation detectors. All of these would be water Cherenkov detectors.
Okay. Yeah, and that then I was going to ask, do they all use water?
These all have out exterior water detection areas, or I should say Vito layers, the muon Vito layers. Particularly because they're underground, they'll have both neutron sources and muons coming through the layer above them. So they do have surrounding water Cherenkov muon Vito layers. That would
Okay,
represent
so
in this one right here, this volume
oh.
right here, and this volume right here that you can see.
Okay, well, what I was thinking then that for the medium in which the interaction occurs, producing the scintillation, then or the Cherenkov signal, is that also water? I seem to recall that like Kamiokande, which detected that the supernova 1987A, and I guess that was the predecessor to Gamland. My recollection is that that used water.
You're absolutely right. And in fact, you're right on a couple of different points. So this is the Camlin detector. This steel vessel is the former Kamiokande
Oh.
detector. Yes, the Kamiokande detector was the detector that observed the supernova 1987. The 1987 supernova detection was a water Cherenkov event. But this is a liquid scintillator. Sorry, this is filled with liquid scintillator. This one's filled with liquid scintillator, and this one using liquid. Linear alkyl benzene. The ones that they're using inside the Camlin right now is a little bit different, but essentially there are complex molecules that is a 1-to-1 ratio of carbon to hydrogen. So they have a fairly large amount of free hydrogen. But the use of to detect electron antineutrinos, you really need to use liquid scintillation. Also, when you're talking about things like Hyper-K, Super-K, IceCube, KM3net, you're using water Cherenkov, but the water Cherenkov energy limit is around 6 to 8 MeV. They cannot see neutrinos of lower energy. These detectors can see neutrinos at less than 1 MeV. However, you need 1.8 MeV to initiate what's called the inverse beta decay. So this inverse beta decay is the electron antineutrino hits a free proton and creates a neutron plus and positron. So that's this bang into the proton, creating a positron and a neutron. And that you, as it says here, to get this to happen, you need more than 1.8 MeV of energy in the neutrino.
Okay,
And in the geological neutrinos, the highest energy, as you can see here, is only about 3.3 MeV, whereas in the reactors, it goes up to about 10 MeV, but mostly 8 MeV and less. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Jeff Norman had a question.
Yes. Does the work that's being done on detecting neutrinos help us predict earthquakes?
No, I think that.
Okay.
Right, Sue, you have a question?
yes, regarding the slide that showed the those red structures within the earth, you didn't specifically say, but I'm assuming those are the same structures that were recently, yes, that one, that were recently hypothesized to be remnants of Theia. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, let's just say that there's been enormous amounts of speculation as to what is the origin of these. And I think you should sit comfortably back and listen to lots of the ideas that the scientists are having, and not essentially agree to any one of them for a while. The degree two structures, two big structures, antipodally displaced. So one is sort of opposite the other, and they seem to be fundamental. One question that has been put forth is, are they structures that have existed inside the Earth since it initially began? Well, we could say that that would sort of be consistent with Theia, which is the idea that a very large body, something the size of Mars, hit the Earth, released a mass of material that would later become the moon, and let's say stirred up a lot of material in the Earth's interior. And perhaps some of that Mars-size impact was embedded into the the bottom of the silicate Earth, and that would represent these two materials. Geologists have also speculated that with plates subducting, surface ocean plates subducting back into the Earth's interior, such as at the Marianas Deep Trench, that this process has been going on for a considerable period of time, maybe 4 billion, maybe 2.5 billion years, that these subducting oceanic structures, or lithospheres, have accumulated over time into areas like this and built up a degree two structures in the Earth's interior. I don't have a preference. I recognize they're there. I recognize that we've identified them for a long period of time, and it takes a while for us to really come up with a good origin for them.
Thank you.
All right, John Hornstein.
Yes. Can the neutrino power from the mantle be estimated from the geomagnetic field that comes from the part of the mantle that's molten? In other words, how much of the mantle is molten?
Well, I would say that generally, a geoscience answer to that would be zero. But to be honest about the situation, there's probably less than 1% of the Earth's mantle is molten.
I see.
And when it is, it's generally in motion, it's moving upwards. It's usually a good reason for the liquid to essentially differentiate from the solid and to move separately. Melting is essentially a process that is associated with decompression and vertical movement. And usually at mid-ocean ridge spreading centers, what you have is the surface plates moving away from each other. As a result of that, you have a force that is trying to drag, if you will, a mantle beneath it upwards, and that will then cause the adiabatic decompression or melting, and that will bring the melt up faster than the solid in that sense. So, now there is speculation that at the bottom of the mantle, there may be a very thin layer of melt. For 20 plus years, we've identified structures called the ULVZ, the ultra low velocity zones. These are 20, 30, 40 kilometers wide, maybe a few kilometers thick. Only recently, 2, 4 years ago, Jessica Irving and her team has identified what she believes might be structures that represent globe encircling melt layers just above the co-mantle boundary. All of this is at the limits of what we can do seismologically, and providing us healthy thoughts to think about what might be down there. So there's a possibility at the bottom of the Earth, there may be melt layers. And at the top of the Earth, we definitely have imaged melt layers that is associated with the production of mid-ocean ridge spreading centers. Or as in the southern Gulf of California, we got a lot of magmatism there. So right at those two boundary layers, the top and bottom of the mantle, we find places that there are short-lived pulses of melt existing. That's characteristic of boundary thermal boundary layers. I actually have no way to relate that to a geoneutrino flux, except to say that melts typically have enrichments in uranium and thorium, because these two elements like to be in the melt and not in the solid crystals that make up the mantle material.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any questions here in the room? Guy?
Yeah, I thought I remembered a bunch of other neutrino experiments, and I just looked it up, and there are actually quite a few other ones that you didn't mention. Any particular reason for leaving those out?
I heard most of that, and I think he said there's quite a number of other neutrino experiments.
Speak into it. It doesn't pick up all the way there.
Sorry. Yes, that's correct. Yeah, I saw quite a long list of other neutrino experiments that you didn't mention. I was just wondering why, you know, you concentrated on about four, I guess about five of them.
You're right. Yes, there's, I don't know, I'll just speculate. There could be about 25 of them, but I definitely have heard about many of them. These are some of the big ones associated with, well, some of the biggest we know of. And these are these really represent the geoneutrino ones, the ones that are really associated with electron antineutrino counting. Other ones that you might have heard of might be the Nova or the Mini Boon, or the one that's being developed right now in the United States is often called LBNE, the Long Baseline Neutrino Experiment, or DUNE. My heavens, it's skipping my brain what DUNE now. DUNE, DU, Underground Neutrino Experiment with Doozle. I guess it's Doozle Underground Neutrino Experiment. And this is associated with a Fermilab to South Dakota experiment, where Fermilab creates a neutrino beamline as well as an antineutrino beamline that will point to the Homestake neutrino detector, and that will look at some of the fundamental attributes of neutrinos themselves. Fermilab to Nova, which is, I think, in northern Minnesota, is another one of these experiments that's ongoing, looking at the oscillation of the neutrino. There are many, many other experiments that are ongoing or have gone on. Many of them associated with what is called neutrinoless double beta decay. And that's actually associated with a unusual form of radioactive decay, where it quickly goes from one state of two neutrons to one state of two protons, where you have a double decay system and no neutrinos given off during that process. It's an unusual predicted state. It would tell us whether or not a neutrino is a Dirac or Mariana particle, which is one of the big questions in science right now, in the neutrino science. And the question is whether or not a antineutrino or a neutrino could oscillate between those two states. or whether or not it is a Dirac particle, which couldn't do that, or a Mariano particle, which could do that. Yes, there are very many different types of these kinds of experiments.
Thank you.
Have another question here in the room. Go ahead. Yep. Come up so he can hear you.
Yes. So a question on the, I guess the chart that you had where you're showing the different crust level detections. I believe one of the lines was the crust at 500 meters.
I'm having a little bit of trouble understanding the crust at 400 meters.
It was a graph and it had the crust split with one for entire crust metal at 500 meters depth. It was showing the detection rate and the error bars of each of the neutrino detectors. Yeah, that one right there.
Mm-hmm.
So the deeper you go, the higher the error and noise or signal noise ratio, I'm guessing. So I'm wondering how much will that be reduced when Juno is online?
Okay. I've many times had conversations with the experimental physicist about this. This is, of course, this is 2005 when the first paper came out in Nature. And the reality is that, you know, this paper was a discovery paper, a little bit rushed. The Japanese versus the Italians. The Japanese had also, I should say, had a very large American contingent on it. Because they had the 2005 Nature paper, they were really, you know, it's discovery since it was published in that sense. But their first experiment basically didn't have a whole lot of data. In fact, if I remember right, this was it was something like 25 plus 19 minus 17 counts. So they were just above the background. And the Boracino was something like 6 plus or minus 4 counts or something like that. And it's just a curiosity that these signals essentially have a similar shape to it, and it sort of quickly drops down and goes over like that. And then you'd say they should have equal prediction to do that, but they weren't doing that. And this is what we've seen. So the red are just plotted in terms of the XY. The background colors, this green, light brown and brown, put in the background, but this is a these are geological predictions, and these red and blue data points are physics data. And that's how we would essentially match what they're saying. Is that answering your question?
Somewhat. I'm wondering if there's a prediction or simulation of what those bars be like when Juno's online.
Okay, let me then highlight that the current, there's one more data point, and that occurred last year. And essentially, it looks like this data point here, and it's right there. This is all the data that we have for Boracino. This is plus minus 15%. This is plus minus 19%. With 1 year of data, Juno will essentially be the same sort of percentage, plus minus somewhere between 15 and 20%. But with 10 years of Juno data, see, this is essentially now it goes to 2025, 2023. At 2023, it's approximately 20 years of data. It's pretty much maxed out, and it's not going to get much better than 15%. But 10 years of Juno data will get it down to 5% or 6%. So really one third of that uncertainty. So that's the kind of projection into the future that we're looking at in terms of the quality of the Juno result. And so just in the physics experiment data set alone, the Juno will see the uncertainty limits dropping quicker than we have in these two experiments, and essentially become one third the size of this in 10 years. I think that's answering your question, right?
Yeah. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right.
Let's give our speaker another round of applause. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Domo arigato gozaimashita.
Okay. Thank you, everybody.
All right. Well, that's it. Thank you for everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And so our next meeting is on April 13th, which will be just after the eclipse. So we'll be looking forward to hearing all the eclipse reports, probably at that meeting. And then be sure to watch your emails as we post information about local events as well. Okay.
The first Exploring the Sky will be 2 days before the eclipse.
Yep, first Exploring the Sky is on April 6th. So if you are in town, be sure to try to help out with that as well. All right. Anything else? All right. Everyone have a good night. Thank you.
Good night.